Hey everybody, it's Kai popping on here to let you know we are taking a little break for the holidays and bringing back some of our most popular episodes of the year. This one you're about to hear also happens to be one of my personal favorites. It's all about modern monetary theory. We get into what it is and how it's being put to the test in this COVID economy. But before we get back to that, I did want to tell you about a fundraising deal happening right now. Backed by popular demand, the most popular of Marketplace swag ever, the Kai PA Pint Glass. It's back. You can get one glass, a pair, or a set of four as a special thank you gift for donating, but only through midnight on New Year's Eve. We're closing in on our goal of $500,000, and we do want to end 2020 on a strong note. So please support us if you can. Check out the Kai PA Glass and all the thank you gifts at marketplace.org/givesmart and help us meet our goal today. And thanks.
Let's do it.
Yep. Oh, there's Tuesday. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, the weekly edition, the big show, the deep dive into one topic followed by your comments today at long last. I know we've sort of been dangling this for a while. In fact, we talked about it so much that we're getting emails about it, like this one from Mike Morin that both asks and introduces the topic. When are you going to stop threatening / enticing us with a modern monetary theory episode and finally produce one? Feed us, Mama Bird. Well, open those gullets, kids. Here it is.
Open those gullets. Okay, so it's perhaps more than, and I don't know, we're going to see what our guest says about this, but perhaps now more than any time in recent past, modern monetary theory is totally relevant, and it's just on the minds of a lot of people who think about this kind of stuff. And it was on your minds as well. In one of our daily episodes a couple of weeks ago, you asked about the federal budget deficit. And I said, I think, look, if you believe in modern monetary theory, it is not actually an issue right now. And this is the time to have this discussion. So that is what we are going to do.
Yeah, exactly. It's also just a sign before we quickly get to our guest of how things have changed, because we brought up the topic of modern monetary theory, I think about a year ago, which means it could have been 5 months. And Kai was like, I don't think that's going to be relevant anytime soon, which at the time was so right. And here we are. Yeah. So to talk about it, we have Stephanie Kelton, the leading expert in the game when it comes to this topic. She's a professor of economics and public policy at Stony Brook University. She served as an advisor to the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign. Her new book is The Deficit Myth, all about modern monetary theory, also part of the national conversation right now. That book comes out on June 9th. Stephanie, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you both for having me.
This could not be, it feels like, more timely. But let's start with, for those who don't know, the basics. What is modern monetary theory? How does it work? I know that it's a whole book as an answer, but hopefully we can make it digestible for the baby birds out there.
Right. So, well, let's just start with what you began with, which is the way that we think about deficits. And you mentioned the title of my book is The Deficit Myth. So one of the things that MMT tries to do is to get us to, in a sense, see more clearly where the limits lie with respect to the federal government's budget, why the federal government's budget doesn't work like a household budget, why it's different from the way a private business or even a state or local government has to operate their finances. So MMT begins with sort of a simple recognition that the federal government, and I'm talking about the United States or countries like it, those that issue what we might call a sovereign currency, Japan, the UK, Canada, Australia, the US, that countries like ours can't go broke, can't run out of money, that the constraints that they face are in the real economy. There is an inflation constraint, but there's not a solvency constraint. So the federal government of the United States of America is never going to run out of dollars, face bills coming due in dollars that it can't afford to pay. Unlike you and I, if the rent comes due, if the mortgage payment comes due, the car payment's due, the student loan debt payment is due, and we don't have the money, we're not going to make the payment. We can default. We can go broke. Federal government is different. It's the issuer of the currency, and everybody else is what we should think of as merely a user of the U.S. dollar. And it makes a big difference.
Okay, so there are a couple of things that I want to try to nail you down on. The first one is that thing you mentioned, the inflation constraint, because you start talking modern monetary theory and people who are skeptical about it will say, oh my God, inflation, all that money, what are you talking about? You're crazy. So why will, in effect, printing whatever money we need to pay our bills not lead to inflation under modern monetary theory?
Well, so you will maybe notice that I never use the phrase printing money, nor do I ever use the phrase printing money.
Yep,
and I don't use
it
because it's not descriptive of how the government actually spends. Okay, so what MMT is recognizing is that there's a spending constraint, but it's not just a constraint on how much the federal government can spend. It's a constraint on how much total spending our economy can take. In other words, we have a productive capacity. We are capable with the workers that we have, with the factories and the machines and the raw materials, we are capable of producing only so much at any point in time, given the technology and the real resources available to us. So if we put too much strain on the system, in total, if total spending is excessive, we are going to create inflationary pressures in our economy. And so there is a limit. The limit is defined by the supply side of the economy, by the capacity constraints. And if we push spending too far, the punishment for that will be inflation. It won't be insolvency, not for the federal government.
Mm-hmm. So how do we control inflation, though?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, what's the mechanism?
Yeah, so the goal would be to recognize that there are limits, to respect those limits, and to avoid pushing spending too far. And look, the Federal Reserve tries to do that, right? Banks make loans, and every time a bank makes a loan, somebody has a new deposit from which they can spend into the economy. If the Federal Reserve gets worried that the economy's starting to heat up, and maybe they think some inflationary pressures are building, what does the Fed do? They raise interest rates. They try to discourage private lenders from making more loans in order to discourage spending. So that's the way we kind of handle inflation today. When we're talking about Congress authorizing spending, what we've just seen, all of us, in the span of the last month and a half or so, is Congress moving some fairly big legislation, right? We had one piece of legislation, the CARES Act, $2.2 trillion. So Congress can authorize $2.2 trillion of new expenditure without what I would call offsets, without a tax increase. And that means that the government is just saying, we're going to spend $2.2 trillion into the economy. Now, the question is that safe? Can the economy handle that $2.2 trillion without some sort of inflation offset, without a tax increase, without carving money out of some other part of the budget? And I think the evidence is pretty clear in the moment that we're spending into a very depressed economy. And so we don't need those inflation offsets at the moment. The time will come, God willing, one day, this economy will come roaring back and we'll get very close to full employment. And that's the time to begin to think about the inflationary consequences of large-scale continued expenditures.
Can I go back to a basic for a second? Because you just clarified that you did not say print money. And I kind of want to understand, and I'm probably not alone here, that as a matter of monetary policy, I'm a little unclear because there is the involvement of creating money, but not just printing money endlessly, right? Can you help me clarify that a little bit or understand that a little better?
So let's think of it this way. The way I think of it, and it's a little bit of a simplification, but it's accurate. It's descriptively accurate. So go back to that $2.2 trillion CARES Act that I just mentioned. When Congress wrote that bill, what that bill did was essentially send a set of instructions to the Federal Reserve, right? The Fed is the U.S. government's bank. It's its fiscal agent. So when Congress passed and the president signed the CARES Act, it was effectively ordering up from the Fed $2.2 trillion. Okay, Congress has the power of the purse, so Congress can commit to spending dollars it does not have. And those payments will be carried out. Those dollars that that Congress is ordering up, the Fed fills that order on behalf of Congress, on behalf of Treasury. How do they fill the order? They use the computer the keyboard at the Federal Reserve, and they make the payments that have been authorized by Congress, and they do it using nothing more than a computer keyboard. So if you like, you could say that the government is making its payments by printing digital dollars called bank reserves. Mm-hmm. So that's really what's happening. I mean, that is an accurate description of how the government actually pays for things.
Got it. And then it is fiscal policy that sort of addresses the concerns about inflation, right? Ideally keeps the kind of spending under control on some level. I'm going all the way to the basics
could.
Here.
It's not the only, it's certainly not the only, and it may not always be the preferred way to think about regulating inflationary pressures. But what I will say is that if we were in an economy that was very close to what economists agreed was full employment, we said there aren't a lot of unemployed people out there. Factories are producing just about at maximum capacity. There's not a lot of fiscal space in the economy. If the government wanted to do something like $1 trillion of infrastructure investment in an economy that was already resource constrained, already operating near full employment, that then invites inflation risk, right? If you were to authorize trillions of dollars of spending on infrastructure in an economy that doesn't have idle resources lying around, construction workers, architects, engineers, steel, machines, equipment, all that kind of stuff, then what you're going to do is create inflationary pressure. On the other hand, if you had the presence of mind and you did due diligence putting your legislation together and you said, look, I think infrastructure is a high priority. We've ignored it for years and years in this country. It's time to do it, even though the economy is resource constrained. So here's what we have to do. To avoid creating an inflation problem, we need to write this spending bill and we need to include some tax increases or we need to cut some other part of the budget. Reduce expenditures on military or whatever the case is, right? That's how, that's the mm-hmm. right way, I would argue, to think about how to responsibly budget our nation's resources so that you could move forward with the infrastructure spending without creating inflationary pressure because you're going to hit the cool valve, if there's such a thing. You're going to you're going to relieve mm-hmm. some spending, right? Remove some purchasing power from the private sector in order to make room for that additional $1 trillion of infrastructure investment, let's say.
Got it. Thank you.
So if this makes so much sense, and if in effect we're seeing, and maybe you'll agree with this, maybe you won't, modern monetary theory light here in this crisis, how come we're not doing this already, you know?
So we are, Kai, we are. The MMT is and has always been for now some 2.5 decades a description of how the federal government's budgeting process works, of how the modern monetary system works, whether we're doing fiscal expansion, whether we're doing austerity, whatever we're doing, MMT works in the sense that it's a description. What we argue is that very often we leave idle resources unemployed that we could have employed and put to work building a better economy. But we are too afraid to increase the deficit, to do what needs to be done to hire those resources and put them to productive use. So we sacrifice in the sense that there's, you know, foregone output. There are opportunity costs associated with leaving millions of people unemployed who want to participate in the economy. They want to work and do something, but they can't find jobs anywhere. We could have hired all of the unemployed and put them to work. We could have taken advantage of the fiscal space that was available, built a better economy, more prosperous, more resilient. But we didn't do that. And much of the time, the reason we don't do that is because, you know, we can't figure out how to pay for things or we worry about adding to the deficit. So here we are. We had the Republicans pass the tax cuts in December of 2017. And a number of my friends, many of whom are economists, said, oh, this is a disaster, right? If the Republicans are successful in pushing these tax cuts through, it's going to add to the deficit, it's going to increase the debt, and it is going to mean that in the years ahead, we as a nation are going to be living on a shoestring. We are going to be incapable of responding when the next downturn comes. We won't have the firepower. You heard all of these arguments, right? And these came from some pretty big names, by the way.
Now we're hearing it today.
Yes.
We're hearing the same argument today.
You are. And guess what? It's wrong today and it was wrong then. And how do we know it was wrong then? Because they told us we wouldn't be able to do what we're doing right now. We have just passed four pieces of legislation, not quote unquote paid for, all of it added to the deficit. We're doing the very thing that these big name economists told us we wouldn't be able to do when a crisis arrived. And guess what? We're doing it, and they were wrong. And those who are saying now that the deficits that we're running up today are going to somehow prevent us from doing what needs to be done 3 months or 6 months or a year from now are wrong too.
Seems to me you got a branding problem and a public relations problem, right? Because Republicans in Congress and in the general think tank sphere have started to, as Molly pointed out, already saying, ooh, gotta worry about the debt and deficit. And you know, Mr. and Mrs. America in Ottumwa, Iowa, or parts of California, or where have you, are going to say, yeah, we can't borrow money. Borrow money's bad, because if I do that in my household, that's terrible. How do you fix that? How do you change that?
So I'll tell you, I can only tell you how I would do it and how I try to do it in interviews and in conversations with lawmakers. And what I do, especially with those who want to, you know, pump the hysteria about the deficit and so forth, I refuse to use the word deficit. Why are you calling it a deficit? That's what I say. Why? Wait a minute. Why are you calling it a deficit? Because when the government runs a budget deficit, it means that the government is spending more dollars into the economy than it is subtracting away by taxing the rest of us, okay, through taxation. So to put numbers to it, if the government spends $100 into the economy, but it only taxes 90 of those dollars back out, we label that a government deficit. And everybody gets hung up on the word, the government's budget is in deficit. What they forget is that if the government drops 100 in and then swipes only 90 back out, it's making a deposit. It's leaving $10 somewhere in the economy for somebody to hold on to. So I would just say to people, you know, why do you want to call it a deficit? Why don't you call it what it really is? It's a surplus. It's a financial surplus in some other part of the economy. This thing that we call the government deficit is nothing more than a financial contribution made by the federal government to some other part of the economy. And you know, the Republicans, you mentioned the Republicans, they clearly understand this. The reason that they were quite happy to increase deficits to the tune of almost $2 trillion with the tax cuts in 2017 is because they understand perfectly well that by increasing the government deficit, they're increasing the financial contribution made to some other part of the economy. They just want to decide where it goes. You know, they say, well, it's going to go to the people who least need the help. 83% of the benefits went to people in the top 1%. But they do understand that there's benefit on the other side, that the government's red ink is somebody else's black ink, that their deficits are someone else's financial surpluses.
Is, do you think, just sort of simply, modern monetary theory uniquely suited to meet this moment? Like, is this a conversation that we should be having, you know, louder and more often?
Well, I'm not going to say no. I mean, yes, I think so.
Okay, then how do we, I guess,
that would be bad.
How does it move forward? How does
branding.
It overcome, very true, but how does it overcome the politics, you know?
Well, I don't know that it completely overcomes the politics, but it certainly puts us in a position to have a better policy debate. And that's all I've ever wanted out of this. I get out of bed every single day. I come, I feel like I have the same, you know, rhetorical fight day after day after day against these myths. I mean, the book is called The Deficit Myth, but there's not just one. There's a whole string of them. So I go after this thing every single day in the hopes that on the other side, we reach a point where we're just having a more productive, fruitful, meaningful debate around these questions. You know, we're still going to have disagreements. Different political parties are going to have different ideas about the best way to use the deficit. But I don't want to continue to treat the deficit itself as a problem. The deficit itself can be the solution to some of our problems. And that's where I'd like us to try to get.
June the 9th is when the book comes out. It's called The Deficit Myth by Stephanie Kelton. She's a professor of economics and public policy at Stony Brook University. Modern Monetary Theory is the subject, available, I would imagine, for pre-order right now. Stephanie, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Stephanie.
Thank you both.
All right, there we go. We answered the mail on that one, I think. A little Modern Monetary Theory tutorial for 17 or 18 minutes.
I know. I think we learned. I am smarter, I think. Yeah. No, I'm definitely smarter. Yeah, well, no, that's fascinating. It's it is such a hard philosophical hill for America to climb, I think, because everybody engages in the conversation. It is ingrained.
It is bred in you. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And something and the defense of it, right? Like nobody ever, it's very interesting to hear Stephanie essentially turn the question around, which is like, why are you calling it a deficit? Everybody falls into, I mean, George Lakoff must be having a field day always listening or even listening to this, which is like everybody falls into the framing that it is a deficit conversation. And it's very interesting to hear her say, what if it wasn't? Which is like, that's the heads blowing.
That's the head exploding sound, yes.
A head exploding sound.
Let us know what you think about modern monetary theory, that discussion we had, what other questions you may have about it, and we'll see if we can answer them. I don't know. Anyway, email, voice memo, take your pick, makemesmart@marketplace.org. We are coming right back. Not coming back if I don't hear the music. I'm just not. I refuse.
We're just not.
I don't know.
I'm out.
Carlton, hit the music.
Okay.
There we go.
And we're back. It's so dramatic. Welcome back, everyone. welcome back.
Like we thought we weren't going to come back.
We did it.
Just not one day. Sorry.
We did.
See you later.
Just let a little dead air go by and see what happens. I'm just still thinking through all of this. I'm still chewing on the modern monetary theory.
It's counterintuitive, right? That's the catch. You have to sort of turn your brain around to think about all this stuff that we've been thinking about generationally in a different way.
Exactly. Like you have to counter program to the idea that if you create money, money will be made, more money will come back in. Right. It's just like a rising Okay. Anyway, I'm gonna pre-order that book. Okay. Before we get to the news fix, we have our funding drive going on, which we wanted to remind you. But more importantly, we wanted to tell you about our gifts because it is not a tote bag.
We got stuff. It is not a tote bag.
We have gotten digital.
it is completely handy in this age of Zoom meetings. By the way, I saw actually somebody, Barry Ritholtz at Ritholtz Wealth Management, friend of the pod. He's friend of Marketplace. His rule is that Zoom meetings have to be less than 30 minutes, and I completely agree. I don't think you can
completely, because no one can look their faces banished. For so long.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. Although, you know what I did, though, the other day? I discovered the hide my image thing on Zoom, and so I leave my camera on, but I deselect my image so that everybody else can see me, but I can't see me, because that's good, because I was spending way too much time looking at myself going, God, you're so gray. Shave, will you? Where'd those wrinkles come from? All that stuff.
I know I do the same thing, but then I'm afraid I'm going to get my like resting old face. You've also got to be vigilant.
Right.
Anyway, all of that is to say, we feel your pain and we are here to help.
Yes. And we know you have to spend some time on Zoom, so you might as well do it with a fun background. So first of all, it's marketplace.org/givesmart is the URL to which you can contribute should you so choose. And if you do, we've got some virtual meeting backgrounds taken at Marketplace headquarters 17 miles south of where I sit. You can have the main studio, which we call Studio E, our main conference room, and also the control room where I believe Charlton Thorpe is sitting right now, in point of fact.
Yeah, I gotta say the control room is the one.
You can get this. Yeah. Yeah, it is. That's totally the one to get one, for sure.
Yeah. And so if you donate 100%. Now, and I would like you to know they're platform agnostic. And the best part actually about the Kai Studio one is it has a pumpkin in there. I don't know if that's just like a little bit of a troll.
It's from when I had to do the pumpkin spice latte thing.
I just love that's the one they use. That's amazing. Yeah. Anyway, so they are platform agnostic. And if you donate now at marketplace.org/givesmart, virtual backgrounds, pretend you're working at Marketplace. It's a fun job, turns out. All right, let's talk
about
the news.
Totally worth it. Okay, I've got two, but they're quick.
I love it.
And they go like this. Number one, you might have heard yesterday that Major League Baseball is thinking about a plan to bring baseball back on the 4th of July with no fans in the stands. Dr. Anthony Fauci, who is clearly arbiter of everything now, said it's feasible that the National Football League could come back this fall. No fans in the stands, of course, and testing of players and all of that jazz. But he said it's feasible. Are we there yet? No, but it's feasible. And I just think, given the national psyche at this moment, that professional sports would be a big value add for those who are sports fans. And that's where I am. That's where I am on that.
I know. I mean, that is like one of those statements that's a wild hope.
Oh, for sure.
Like,
for sure.
Like, you're just like, let it be. Yep.
Yeah. To quote Fauci again, you know, we're not in charge of this. The virus is in charge. But I think it's interesting that he felt confident enough to say that that was feasible, which is good. Here's another thing, though. And I think this is really interesting because this is a harbinger of workplaces' future. Jack Dorsey apparently sent out a note to his staff today that said, hey, you Twitter people, you want to work from home forever? Go ahead. Fine with me. And I just think that's really interesting, you know?
For some. For some. Yeah. No, absolutely. That is a huge deal. I was going to choose the same thing, so I'm glad you picked it because that's what we're talking about. And it's just like one. Now that's sort of like he pulled the drain, right? You're going to see a lot more of that conversation. In fact, I was even telling a friend of mine who was laid off, like, maybe you can now take a job in Silicon Valley because, because location doesn't matter anymore. You're not going to have to drive down there. Yep, totally.
Yep.
Speaking of Silicon Valley, I'm serious. Like, what? It doesn't need to. I don't know.
Yep.
It's going to take so long for these changes to unfold, and it's easy to forget because we're just living like day by day. But 10, 15, 20 years from now, so many things are going to be different as a result of this exact moment. And sometimes you can history geek about that and just think it's like kind of.
I'm
not going to say it's neat, but it's.
On the daily thing.
Fascinating.
No, it is neat. Exactly. Oh, no, I think it's really cool. I think it's really neat. You know, not often do you live. Well, that's not true because it's happened like three times in the last 20 years, right? But not often do you live through moments in
history
except 9/11,
the
great financial crisis, and this. But yeah.
Right.
That's true.
But still,
anyway.
It's still a big deal.
Yeah.
Also today in Silicon Valley news that I thought was fascinating, Uber, apparently, according to the Wall Street Journal, is seeking to acquire Grubhub, the meal delivery service. It would actually unite two of the biggest players in meal delivery because, of course, Uber has Uber Eats and no other business right now. And I find this fascinating for a lot of reasons. One is like, it's sort of in keeping with my theme of like, apparently the competition regulators are also at home goofing off of Zoom backgrounds.
that's so funny. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah.
Or at least we will find out if they are at home goofing off of Zoom backgrounds right now, because that would be a large consolidation in that space, which is arguably, yes, very competitive. But still, it is not guaranteed also that the journal points out that the talks will produce a deal. But here's the other reason that I think this is really interesting is because Travis Kalanick, remember that guy, has been apparently off working on a startup called Cloud Kitchen that is all about creating these ghost kitchens, they call them, which I think is a fascinating story. You guys should totally do this on PM, the ghost kitchen thing, because this is what restaurants are going to be in the next 10 years, which is essentially like white label, right? It's just a kitchen. They make food, a certain kind of food. And then somebody like Uber Hub Eats Grub comes and picks it up and brings it to you. And so
Travis Kalanick, by the way, founded Uber, we should say.
Yes, founder and ousted CEO of Uber, but apparently still has like, he's got tentacles at Uber.
Yeah.
And I'm just saying that a big, huge meal delivery giant would be an awesome launch partner for what is reportedly Travis Kalanick's new startup, which is all about food delivery. I thought that was fascinating. I was like, on the one hand, yes, this is a smart look at what the future is going to hold business-wise, because Uber rides are not going to go back to normal for a really long time. And second, it's good news for Travis.
Mm-hmm.
Good news for Travis.
For sure.
All right, that's all I got. I'm skipping the other one.
Okay. All right.
That's it.
Very well.
Your
Let
turn.
Let us proceed.
Yep. Time for the mail.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
All right.
Oh, man, I am so here for this next email. One of the first deep dive episodes that we did when the pandemic hit was, of course, the impact of school closings. And what we learned is that schools are this huge part of the social safety net. I know I'm not telling you anything that you don't know, but one of the essential roles they play is being a place for children to go during the day while parents are at work. Not to mention get food and internet access and all of that. But now that the national conversation is shifting to how and when we can go back to work and summer is upon us and it's unclear if, you know, offices and camps and school are all going to open at the same time, probably not. Lisa Ferreira wants to know, what about the children? She writes, in all the talk about reopening and going back to work, I can't understand why there's been zero conversation about how to handle child care. With schools out basically through summer, we can't just go back to work with no place for our children. It seems like figuring this out should be a prerequisite to getting the economy going. I'm reading it in my mad voice because I am so with you, Lisa. She says, I'm like, what is it, Mrs. Potato Head? Don't forget your angry eyes. Parents are already trying to juggle homeschool and work, and now they're going to be further penalized by not being as available to return to reopening offices and workplaces. My friends and I have decided this is the result of mostly men being in charge. Sorry, Kai. My husband and I have both been able to transition our jobs to working from home and caring for our two 11-year-olds. And though our income has been dramatically affected by all of these events, we can do work from home. My peers aren't so lucky. I mean, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
To this.
For sure.
It's not even a conversation. For it's like reopen the economy. Don't know where your kids are going to go. They're already like, yeah. Yep. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yep.
I've also been ranting all weekend long about how like every conversation we have about reopening is just literally about like, how can you shop? As opposed to how can you safely create a bubble of two families who have been sheltered in place for 8 weeks, let's say, to improve your mental health and give you an opportunity to engage with other humans and get hugs. Like, we don't have those, you know, happiness conversations. We're just having the how can you shop conversation. I just sometimes get my angry eyes. Your turn.
I have no further comments, Your Honor. Okay, so... one of the things that happens when we're in a pandemic, as we are now, is that hospitals have had to react for various and sundry reasons, including canceling elective surgeries or other procedures that could be put off long enough to deal with what was expected to be the crush of COVID patients, which has happened in some places and not in others. But, and here's the question from Sharon Zimmerman. She wants to know what happens to the thousands of Americans out there with chronic health conditions that need treatment but who are being told to stay home. So here's what she says. One thing I haven't heard about in the health crisis is the impact of deferred treatment of chronic health conditions. For 2+ years, I've been in treatment for periodontal disease. I count myself blessed to be an essential business with good benefits, but guidance has been patchwork and unclear about when to seek non-emergency care. I'm beginning to worry that I will see a setback in the improvements that I have made. I know I can't be the only one trying to navigate routine care, but no one seems to be talking about it. I almost deleted this message 5 times because I feel guilty for even worrying about this when people are fighting for their lives. Maybe that's why the issue isn't being discussed. I think maybe that's part of it, right? That people are just not focusing on the, you know, maintenance stuff because crisis is in the ether. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I have seen conversation about it, and it's really real because those chronic health conditions create even longer term chronic health conditions. And, you know, I mean, I have a friend with lupus who couldn't get medication for a while. A less angry way to say that when we talk about reopening, what we're talking about is a whole series of things, right? We know that the lockdown has lots of knock-on effects. Some of them are economic. Lots of them are related to mental health. Many of them are related to ongoing care. And It should be a bigger and more holistic conversation than it is. And sadly, it is mostly just about politics and or death, the end. And it's that's way too simple. Sure. And so don't feel guilty, Sharon.
Right. And I think it adds to the frustration over this that while in some places, certainly hospitals have been slammed by COVID patients, in a lot they haven't because the curve has been flattened and extended and there is still capacity. And yet guidance has not been immediately forthcoming on resuming some of those elective treatments and procedures, which is really, really frustrating, I'm sure, for people who are in that situation, you know?
Yeah, it is. And if we were able to say, you know, with certainty and trust, this will last 4 months, right? Like, we will stay home for 4 months, crush the curve. We will reopen on this date with this amount of testing. I mean, I know, believe me, I know this is an ideal scenario that, you know, I'm not sure anybody has successfully pulled off, but then you'd be like, okay, right? Okay, I know that. Yep. I know that that is the case. I will probably not have a setback. I've been in conversation with my doctor about this period of time and how to manage it. It's the complete open-endedness that I think is causing so many people to freak out on lots of different levels.
Yeah,
and
no.
I get it. We hear you.
Yep.
2 weeks ago, speaking of testing, we did our show on testing. We talked to Lauren Wold. We got super smart about how the tests work and so why
awesome
it's so
Lauren
hard.
Wold, by the way.
The awesome Lauren Wold, the most successful guy from my high school, Dr. Lauren Wold. And before that, I had talked about Apple and Google's contact tracing app here on Marketplace and on Marketplace Tech. On that topic, here is a voice memo from an epidemiologist named Ian Bukta.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Ian from Iowa City. I was thinking a lot about your story with the Apple and Google contact tracing app, and I thought that as an epidemiologist, this could be quite useful to us, but there are some serious limitations beyond just the testing. One limitation I see is that it misses fomite transmission. So fomite transmission is when people touch contaminated surfaces and then become infected with the virus. Because it relies on Bluetooth, it's not going to do anything for fomite transmission. So you're not going to be able to build the contact tracing network and links as you would hope to build. So between missing those transmissions and also just the leakiness of people having to opt into the app, I wonder if this is going to be as useful as they hope.
Yeah, totally maybe. And also privacy concerns, yes. But why not just try?
There's a bajillion.
I mean, isn't it better to have some data than not?
I mean, that's what I came to eventually too, was that if they get an app and they remember I was like, I was wrong. And if it is one of many things in a pile that could be helpful.
Yeah, yeah.
It's still better than nothing.
Because right now, our pile of things that could be helpful is small, shall we say, you know?
Yes.
Right?
For the pile.
It's a small pile. it's a small pile. That's what we're looking for.
Looking for
a pile in a haystack. Anyway, all right, we go out as we always do on the Make Me Smart question. What is something you thought you knew but then found out you were wrong about? Patrick McGinnis has the answer this week. He is the guy who coined the phrase FOMO, fear of missing out, rather. I know. He hosts a podcast. It's called FOMO Sapiens. His new book is called Fear of Missing Out. Just came out this week. Here he is, Patrick McGinnis, with a Make Me Smart question.
What's something I thought I knew that later I found out I was wrong about? I thought I knew everything about FOMO. It's that anxiety you get when you feel like other people are doing things that are better than what you're doing at the moment. Here's what I've learned about FOMO living in New York City, the city with perhaps the most FOMO in the world in the age of COVID-19. With all of the external stimuli removed from our lives, we no longer needed to keep up. And FOMO, it seemed, was over. But was it? No, it just evolved. Mm-hmm. Now it's about missing out on the lives we might have led in that sliding doors alternate universe where COVID-19 never happened. As we miss out on time with family and friends, we're coming to realize that we're also missing out on so much that we took for granted just months ago. Restaurants, subway rides, Broadway shows, dating, sporting events, the gym, handshakes, and hugs. I take comfort in the fact that someday, not too far in the future, there will once again be parties and events and jobs and vacations that look amazing from the outside. We'll all once again have something to miss out on.
Yeah. Aww, no, look, I totally buy that. The fear of the lives we were going to have. You bet. I think that's, I really like that.
I do too.
It's good.
I do too. It's partly the morning, but it does also, like, I found myself, that's so funny. I found myself thinking that just yesterday. I was like, are we going to start to feel stuck? Like, I was like, I don't feel it yet, but are we going to start to feel like, what could, you know how you always have that nagging existential
totally
question,
stuck.
Like, could I be doing more with my life? And now we're just like, I'm stuck. I'm literally on pause. And how long is it going to last?
Yeah.
And then should I be coming up with a plan? Somebody asked me, like, what's your big plan for when this is all over? And I was like, what? I don't know.
Are you kidding
Maybe
me?
Actually cut and eat the arugula from the garden? Like, back off, man. My plan is survival.
Yeah, no, totally. That's exactly right. Look, oh my God. I mean, I get that you want to be ambitious and have goals and this and that, but I would humbly suggest that now is not the time to raise that bar, man. Getting out of bed every morning And look, my life is ridiculously easy right now. I've been moaning and complaining and all this jazz. But look, I mean, come on. Yeah. For those of us who have the luxury of working from home, shut up.
Mm-hmm. You don't need to also learn a language, though, if you're teaching. Yeah. And speaking of that, I have to go now because I have to get my kid to his, you know, we have to finish the English essay. That's why I'm not learning a language.
My daughter's doing Duolingo all by herself.
What? Mm. Oh, my God.
Anyway.
Right. To be fair, my kid has a business plan. We'll talk about it later. It's so interesting to see them, right? Like they're whatever their self-directedness is, and it's only going to increase over the summer, to Lisa's point.
Yep.
Heaven help us. All right, that's it for our show today. Now we're just wandering. Sign up for the Make Me Smart newsletter at marketplace.org/newsletters. There's all kinds of good, useful information in there if you feel like you need to like up your learning game. It's an easy, no-pressure way to do it because it comes right to you every Friday morning. We'll see you back here tomorrow. What do you want to know Wednesday?
I know. Here we go. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. Our senior producer is Jody Becker. Thanks to our video producer, Ben Hethcote, our video intern, Ethan Parrots, and writer-producer, Erica Phillips.
Today's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Satara Nieves. And the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. I did it. Phew.
It was the short music. It was the short music.
I know. That was because Charlton is like, I've had it with you people.
Charlton's it's like 11 Charlton's like, I got things to do, man. Cut it out. Short music.
Seriously.
Leave me alone. All right, everybody.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.